Okay, good evening. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's ultimately going to be going into radiology. This is episode 108 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast episode, I will be continuing our review for the ABIM exam, so the medicine board exam. Again, like I said on my website, these are also useful for like the medicine in training exam that you take every year as an internal medicine resident, and also the USMLE Step 3 exam, right? Because the USMLE Step 3 exam tends to test a lot of internal medicine concepts. So this will be series 7 with that, and today I'm going to be talking about rheumatology. So let's jump right into it. But the first thing I'll say, actually, let me say a few quick things about rheumatology, right? So rheumatology on the exam, I would kind of highly encourage you to know the classic imaging findings of many of the diagnoses in rheumatology. The medicine board exam, they actually do love to test imaging quite a bit. They won't make it like hard imaging. They'll make it something that is very easily recognizable. But I'll encourage you to be able to sort of like recognize those things, right? And then another useful thing is just sort of paying attention to patterns, right? And that's one thing I'm going to try to do today. I'm going to establish like pretty classic patterns of many of the rheumatologic diseases. And again, this will be a series. I will make more rheumatology podcasts attuned to this exam. Again, I want this to be something you can just listen to on your way home from work or something like that. And one thing I'll say is many people have asked me to try to put this podcast on Apple Podcasts, and I promise I have tried multiple times. I don't know, I just keep getting into an error message. It just never seems to go through. I don't know if it's something with the website or what, but I will keep trying my best to figure it out. It probably, especially after intern year, I'll probably try to devote a couple of hours and see how things go. Okay. So the one of the main diagnoses you want to be able to make on your test with regards to rheumatology is arthritis, right? You know that there's rheumatoid, there's osteoarthritis, there's the spondyloarthropathies and whatnot, right? But the thing is, when you're trying to make the diagnosis of arthritis, right, usually makes sense to try and ask yourself, is it an inflammatory arthritis or a non-inflammatory arthritis? If it's non-inflammatory, you're probably thinking more about like OA, right? So like osteoarthritis. If it's more inflammatory, you're thinking about rheumatoid arthritis, right? There's many other things that can cause those patterns, but those are the mainstream ones. And I'll talk about the non-mainstream ones as we proceed, right? And then if a person has like a symmetric arthritis, right, you're probably thinking more about like rheumatoid arthritis. It tends to cause like symmetric joint involvement, like, oh, they'll say like, oh, both of my hands hurt and stuff like that, versus osteoarthritis that is more asymmetric, right? Or the spondyloarthritis, that the spondyloarthropathies, those also tend to be asymmetric, right? And then, I mean, if you check like the joint fluid, if the white cell count is less than 2000, right, you know you're thinking more about the non-inflammatory arthritis, right? And usually the neutrophil like percent of that white count is usually less than 25%. So contrast that with septic arthritis, where the white count is almost always greater than 50,000 on these tests, and the neutrophil percent is usually greater than 75%, right? So that's something you'd want to keep at the back of your mind. So what if they give you a question about like a 65-year-old guy comes in, says, "Doc, my legs have been hurting for the past six months, and it's like both of my knees hurt, but my right knee hurts more than my left, right? And let's say this guy, his BMI is 36, right? If you see all those things, the guy is obese, he's having asymmetric joint pain, right? And let's assume you do a physical exam, you don't see any redness or soft tissue swelling or anything of that sort, right? You can pretty much make the clinical diagnosis of osteoarthritis under those circumstances, right? So what are the big things you see with osteoarthritis on exams, right? So again, like I said, they'll have asymmetric joint involvement. So it's not the entire joint that will be involved. It will be like one side of a joint that is involved. Although obviously if a person has like late stage osteoarthritis, then they'll have like multiple, like most of the joint involved. But I'll tell you this, usually on exams, let's say for example, if they have like inflammation in the knee, right? It's a non-inflammatory arthritis, but if they have like knee involvement, for example, it will be like the medial side of the knee, so the insides of the knee that hurts the most. Okay, it's not going to be the entire joint. And then the extremity involvement is, again, usually asymmetric, right? So let's say they may say, oh, both of my knees hurt, but one hurts more than the other. They tend to have like more symptoms in one joint compared to the contralateral joint in the other extremity, right? And then you want to know the classic things you find on imaging, right? So you'll find like the osteophytes. An osteophyte is almost like extra bone that you find within the joints, like around the joint. And then don't forget like your sclerosis, right? So basically, if you look around the articular cartilage part of the joint, if you see things becoming like white, if you see more white, it's just something that happens as kind of like reactive remodeling because the articular cartilage is being like essentially worn down, right? And then you also can observe a subchondral cysts. So subchondral, chondral means cartilage, right? So below the articular cartilage layer of the joint, if you look below and you see like almost like punched out like black, right? So like more radiolucent parts below the articular cartilage, that's what's known as a subchondral cyst. And I mean, I believe the pathophysiology involves like some of the joint fluid sort of herniating through the defects in the articular cartilage. And again, don't forget, if you tap that joint, the white count will be less than 2,000. The percent of the neutrophils will be less than 25%. And don't forget that these people, right, again, because it's a non-inflammatory arthritis, they will tend to have like a negative ESR, an ESR that would not be significantly elevated. So just something to keep at the back of your mind, right? And again, remember, because it's a non-inflammatory arthritis, these people would not have, they would not necessarily have joint stiffness. So if you have joint stiffness, it will be for less than an hour in the morning. And then they will have like their joint pain sort of getting worse because, right, as you bear more weight on the joint, it hurts more. Right, so those are the big things you want to keep in mind. And then also don't forget kind of like the distribution of the arthritis, right? So the thing is, osteoarthritis tends to affect the DIPs, so your most distal knuckles, right? So the knuckles that are closest to your nails, right? So they will have it affects like the DIPs. It also affects like the first carpal metacarpal joint, right? So like the almost like the base of your thumb towards the wrist. Osteoarthritis loves to affect that joint. And then it also affects the PIPs, right? So sort of contrast that with like rheumatoid arthritis that loves to affect like the wrist, the MCPs, the PIPs, right? Versus again, osteoarthritis that tends to torch your DIPs, your first carpal metacarpal joint, and your PIPs. In fact, the most commonly affected joints in rheumatoid arthritis, in osteoarthritis in the hand, are the DIPs. Okay, at the DIPs. That's actually very high yield to know for exams. And remember that thing I said that on imaging you may find like extra bone. That extra bone, it usually kind of grows off to the side in the joints. That's what's known as an osteophyte. The thing is, when you have those osteophytes, right, they can cause like soft tissue like impingement, and they can sort of cause pain, or they can sort of cause like deformities, right, that you can see on a physical exam, right? So those osteophytes, if you find them in the PIPs, those are the things that are known as the Bouchard's nodes. But if you find like these osteophytes in the DIPs, those are the things that are known as the Herberdine's nodes. So people are like, oh, Divine, how do I remember that crap? Let me just tell you how, right? So your PIPs, if you're just sort of going towards your nail, you have your PIPs come first before your DIPs, right? In the self same way, B comes before H in the alphabet. So that's kind of like the way to remember the progression with that. And again, I already said if osteoarthritis is affecting the knees, it'll hurt more on the inside, right? So it basically affects like the medial tibiofemoral compartment, right? And I guess there's this kind of osteoarthritis that may look like he has like some similar findings to rheumatoid arthritis. It's called erosive osteoarthritis. It almost always shows up, if I will tell you, for all intents and purposes, on any exam you take, it should show up in the hand. That's it. Shows up in the hands for the most part, and it tends to affect women that are kind of like around a menopause. And most of the joint damage, it's usually like in the DIPs. Usually in the DIPs. Again, so high yield things to keep in mind. So, how do we treat osteoarthritis, right? So you can tell your patients to lose weight, right? I mean, being obese is actually like a big risk factor for osteoarthritis. If you lose weight, you can actually improve many of your symptoms, right? And remember, don't sort of mix this up, right? So remember, obesity increases your risk of osteoarthritis, but obesity actually decreases your risk of osteoporosis, right? Because remember, when you weight bear, right, if you're obese, you're constantly weight bearing. So that will make your bones even stronger, right? So that decreases your risk of osteoporosis, but it increases your risk of osteoarthritis. So weight loss works pretty well in osteoarthritis, but also don't forget, right, if you want to treat, right, you classically treat with like acetaminophen, I'll say in general on exams you should probably consider going with acetaminophen first instead of an NSAID. So acetaminophen first instead of an NSAID, but if you don't see acetaminophen as an answer choice, go ahead and choose an NSAID. Remember, acetaminophen is not an NSAID, okay? Acetaminophen is not an NSAID. It works centrally. It is not an NSAID. And then if a person has like pretty severe osteoarthritic symptoms, and let's assume they have like a contraindication to taking NSAIDs, and it's just like one joint when they are, where they are having a pretty severe symptoms, another acceptable thing you can do on the exam is to actually go ahead and inject corticosteroids into that joint, although that's usually like a rare scenario that presents on tests. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about osteoarthritis. Okay, so I think it's probably useful to maybe try and compare and contrast osteoarthritis as I discuss rheumatoid arthritis, right? So I said that osteoarthritis tends to be asymmetric joint involvement. That's different in rheumatoid. In RA, you have like symmetric involvement of the joint, right? So usually, like if you look at, let's say, like knee rheumatoid arthritis, both the medial side and the lateral side of the knee joint will be affected. Okay, and remember that unlike osteoarthritis that tends to affect the PIPs, the DIPs, and the first CMC, rheumatoid arthritis tends to affect more of like the wrists, affects your MCPs and your PIPs. It does not affect the DIPs for the most part on exams, right? And remember, these people's joints will be like warm, it'll be red. Unlike osteoarthritis where you have like stiffness less than an hour, right? The stiffness is usually greater than an hour. Rheumatoid arthritis, and unlike osteoarthritis where your symptoms sort of get worse as the day goes on because you are more weight bearing, rheumatoid arthritis, as you sort of work out those joints, it actually gets better as the day proceeds. Being stationary makes your rheumatoid arthritis symptoms worse because by moving that extremity, you're sort of like shaking off the inflammation, if you may, right? And the thing is, on physical exam, there are some pretty classic things you can find in rheumatoid arthritis, right? So like one thing you can find is ulnar deviation, right? So basically it's like the entire like hand is deviating towards the ulnar side, right? Remember, your ulnar side is the pinky side of that extremity. So as your hands are deviating towards the pinky side, that's what's called a ulnar deviation, right? And then the thing is, all that inflammation in the joint can actually cause something known as joint subluxation, right? So it's like the joints sort of move in like weirder directions, right? And that can create something that you've probably heard of. You've probably heard of the boutonniere deformity and the swan neck deformity, right? So let me just give you a quick clue here, and this will make your life more profoundly easy. So the thing is, I mean, if you listen to one of my super early podcasts on like the central dogma of studying, I always encourage people to try to learn the least amount of information that will enable them to control the most amount of knowledge, right? So you can see people, they try to memorize every nook and cranny of crap. That's not a smart way to learn, right? If you want to learn like some small information that you can then build other information on from scratch, right? So for example, to remember like, oh, what is swan neck? What is boutonniere? Literally all I remember is, I just remember that like the term like SF, right? So like SEF, like S-E-F, S-E-F, S-E-F in that order. So the swan neck deformity, that's the S, right? Again, if you're going from proximal to distal, you go with your PIP first and then your DIP, right? So you in your swan neck deformity, you have extension of your PIP and then you have flexion of your DIP. So flexion of your DIP means that like your last knuckle for your fingers, is kind of pointing downwards, okay? So that joint, your DIP is held in flexion. So remember SEF, swan neck deformity, extended PIPs, flexed DIPs. That's all you need to remember. Then just remember that the other one is the other one, right? So boutonniere's deformity has to be the exact opposite. So like flexed PIP and an extended DIP. But again, you don't have to remember that. Just remember the SEF and you should be good to go. And again, because it's an inflammatory arthritis, right? These people have like soft tissue swelling and stuff like that. And the thing is, rheumatoid arthritis, they love to test many high yield scenarios with it, right? Many very great high yield scenarios. So basically, I'm going to try to tell you like all the different ways they can test rheumatoid arthritis on your exam, right? So one way they can test rheumatoid arthritis on your exam is to tell you about a person that has had like long-standing rheumatoid arthritis, and the person is going for like an elective, some kind of elective procedure, some kind of elective surgery. And then they ask like, what's your next best step in management? You definitely want to make sure that you get like x-rays of the neck, right? So like you want to get like a C-spine x-ray with like flexion and extension views. Because remember, rheumatoid arthritis has a strong association with something known as atlanto-axial instability. Remember your atlas and your axis, like C1, C2. With all the destruction that happens in rheumatoid arthritis, you can destroy that joint. And if you destroy that joint, and let's say you go to surgery and anesthesia sort of manipulates your neck to intubate, you can basically disengage the person's head from the rest of the body, right? And you can essentially like sever the spinal cord. And I mean, that patient is likely gonna die, right? So you don't want to do that. So before, if you're doing pre-ops as like an internal medicine resident and a person has like long-standing rheumatoid arthritis, you absolutely positively need to send them for C-spine x-ray with flexion and extension views. Very important to do that. And other people that can have atlanto-axial instability, just for purposes of test taking, people with Down syndrome, right? Keep that at the back of your mind. The classic way they present that, this will probably be more for step 3. They will describe a person has a history of Down syndrome and the person is about to start participating in sports. You want to go ahead and get that C-spine x-ray that's with flexion and extension views. And then also don't forget stuff like patients with ankylosing spondylitis. That's another classic group of patients that can get atlanto-axial instability. And then the fourth group that are tested on exams will be the patients that have a JIA, so juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So just keep those four patient populations at the back of your mind: ankylosing spondylitis, JIA, rheumatoid arthritis long standing, and okay, let me reel them off again. Ankylosing spondylitis, rheumatoid arthritis, JIA, and Down syndrome. Okay, those are the four patient populations that you sort of kind of want to make sure you rule out atlanto-axial instability. And they test this all the time on the ABAIM exam. They tested a ton on the USMLE exam. So it's just one of those high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And if I'm remembering correctly, they love to test that crap as well on the surgery shelf exam. Okay, so so that's one key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And remember, rheumatoid arthritis, right? Those people have like chronic inflammation, so they can have like a normocytic, normochromic anemia, right? So they'll have like anemia of chronic disease. Remember, anemia of chronic disease, it's usually normocytic on exams, but it could also be microcytic, right? But remember that in anemia of chronic disease, those people's ferritins will be high, right? On like patients that have like microcytic anemia from iron deficiency. Remember, iron deficiency anemia is the most common cause of microcytic anemia. But if you have microcytic anemia and anemia of chronic disease, on like iron deficiency anemia, where the ferritin is low, in anemia of chronic disease, the ferritin is high. Okay. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, and again, right, obviously, they'll have, like, the high ESR, CRP because it's an inflammatory arthritis. They'll have, like, a white count if you do, like, tap their joint fluid. So if you do an atherosynthesis, the white count in that joint fluid will be more than 2,000, right? And remember, these people can have, there are some key antibodies you want to know, right? So don't forget your RF antibodies, right? So your rheumatoid factor. I remember your rheumatoid factor is like an IgM antibody against the constant region of IgG. So it's an IgM antibody against the IgG, right? It's one of the antibodies you find in RA. And remember that it's sensitive for RA, right? It's not specific for RA. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. But the other classic antibody, right, is like the anti-CCP antibody. So like the anti-cyclic citrullinated peptide or polypeptide antibody, that's more specific for rheumatoid arthritis. And usually if you sort of combine like positive rheumatoid factor, positive CCP, the person has rheumatoid arthritis, end of story. You don't have to argue that any further. And again, your classic imaging findings in rheumatoid arthritis, right? Don't forget your periarticular osteopenia, right? So again, periarticular, peri means around the articular part of the cartilage, right? So so you look at the cartilage, right, and you see like black above and below the joint. So let's say you're looking at the knee joint, right? It's like, oh, like below the joint you're seeing like a lot of black, above the joint a lot of black, right? So like more radiolucency, that sort of gets you thinking about come on, divine, think. That sort of gets you thinking about the periarticular osteopenia, right? Remember, if you're osteopenic, right, there's less calcium in that bone. So because there's less calcium, you have less X-ray attenuation, right? So your things are a little more radiolucent. And then don't forget, actually, you want to not forget your boss, this boss phrase, your marginal erosions. It's kind of like an animal came and like beats the side of the joint. The classic way you'll see it on imaging is if you look at the sides of the joint, you see like it's like a part of the joint is missing, and it's kind of like missing in like a curved fashion. That's what's referred to as a marginal erosion, right? And remember, rheumatoid arthritis, again, it can involve many other parts of the body, right? It can cause like interstitial lung disease. You can see people that they'll have like pneumoconiosis in the setting of rheumatoid arthritis. Remember, that's what's known as Kaplan syndrome, right? And it doesn't have to be a co-worker's pneumoconiosis only. It can be any kind of pneumoconiosis. If you see that with rheumatoid arthritis, that is that's a Kaplan syndrome. So the Kaplan, that's with a C. So kind of like the test prep company, but instead of a K, put a C for that, right? And then if they can give you a question about a patient has rheumatoid arthritis, and then they tell you that they have like a large spleen, and then they give you like a low white blood cell count, you really want to think about something known as Felty syndrome under those circumstances, right? So the way I remember the findings in Felty syndrome is the mnemonic RANS, so like RANS. The RA stands for rheumatoid arthritis, obviously, and then the N stands for neutropenia, and then the S stands for splenomegaly, right? And again, they won't give no sane question writer will say, oh, a patient with rheumatoid arthritis presents with neutropenia and splenomegaly. No, no one is going to do that crap. If that's what you're expecting, you're probably going to be in for a rude awakening on your exam, right? They'll give you like labs, you'll see like a low icon, you're like, person's white count is like 1,000, right? And then they may describe like left upper quadrant fullness or something like that to tell you that it's splenomegaly, right? So they just basically use code words to describe the classic findings, and then you kind of make the diagnosis, right? So that's why I try to talk people through exam scenarios whenever I'm making these podcasts, because at the end of the day, that's what ultimately counts, right? And remember, rheumatoid arthritis can cause many other things. It can cause myocarditis, it can cause pleural effusions, it can be a presentation of carpal tunnel syndrome. Remember, anything that makes you edematous increases your risk of carpal tunnel syndrome, right? So like rheumatoid arthritis, being pregnant, right? Those are all classic things that can increase your risk of a carpal tunnel syndrome. Also, don't forget, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they actually have a pretty high risk of a lymphoma. Lymphoma is actually a relatively common complication in people that have a rheumatoid arthritis. So it's just one of those weird questions that you want to keep at the back of your mind that most people, for some reason, keep getting wrong. And also, right, again, you can get like, you can see like pleural effusions in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Right. So what are some high yield things as I begin to round up this podcast? Some high yield things about rheumatoid arthritis is the pharmacology, right? And this thing is incredibly frustrating for many people. The thing is, rheumatoid arthritis pharmacology, I will encourage you to learn it in the context of scenarios. Okay, that is how they usually present these things on the exams, right? So let's sort of talk through those. Now, the thing is, if a person has like, they have like acute like worsening of their symptoms, joints are hurting a ton, they're having significant symptoms, right? You can go ahead and give those people NSAIDs, right? In the acute phase, right? Just to sort of like calm down their symptoms. But remember, NSAIDs do not modify the disease course, right? If a patient has rheumatoid arthritis and you want to go ahead and start them on a medication on your exam, go ahead and start them on methotrexate, okay? Now, if methotrexate doesn't work, doesn't control their symptoms appropriately, then just go ahead and move to like a biologic, right? And I'll talk about that in a bit. But, so let's assume you start a patient on methotrexate, right? And then they tell you that this patient, over the last like week or two, they're having like this cough that is like non-productive. They're having fevers. They're having shortness of breath. You probably want to go ahead and consider stopping the drug, right? Because remember, methotrexate can cause like a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, right? And remember that it can also sort of, it's hepatotoxic, right? So it can raise your LFTs. Remember, methotrexate can actually cause interstitial lung disease, right? So it can cause a pulmonary fibrosis, right? So if they give you a question about a patient has a history of rheumatoid arthritis, was started on methotrexate, and then they give you PFTs, and you see like the FEV1 to FVC ratio being normal or elevated, right? So like greater than 0.8, and they have like a reduced DLCO, right? Don't forget methotrexate longer toxicity. Also, don't forget your other drugs, right, that can cause pulmonary fibrosis. Nitrofurantoin, right, so Macrobid can cause a pulmonary fibrosis. What's the name of this other drug? It's an anti-cancer agent, bleomycin. Bleomycin can also cause pulmonary fibrosis. And then also don't forget amiodarone. Remember, amiodarone is a class 3 antiarrhythmic. It's a potassium channel blocker. It also does have the ability to cause interstitial lung disease. Okay, now, what if they can give you a question about a patient that they give you labs and you're like, man, all this person's blood cell counts, like their white count, everything is all low. And let's assume it's a person that's been treated for rheumatoid arthritis, and then they have like some kind of like skin and soft tissue infection or UTI, and you're giving them like trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole for that. Remember that methotrexate inhibits the folate pathway, right? But TMPSMX also inhibits the folate pathway. For those of you that are taking step 3, remember that the TMP part, trimethoprim inhibits dihydrofolate reductase, just like methotrexate. And then the SMX part, right? So the sulfamethoxazole inhibits dihydropterate synthesis. So those both inhibit the folate pathway. So you can have like an additive effect. So you can get like a profound bone marrow suppression if a patient is taking like methotrexate and another anti folate agent, right? So like trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, pyrimethamine even, right? Again, those things can all cause a profound bone marrow suppression, right? So how do you rescue the bone marrow under those circumstances? I hope you're thinking about the folinic acid analog, leucovorin, right? It can basically like bypass the pathway and rescue the bone marrow under those circumstances. So again, don't forget methotrexate can also raise your LFTs, right? And the thing is, methotrexate is a teratogen. Lady's pregnant and she has rheumatoid arthritis, bye-bye methotrexate. Okay, bye-bye methotrexate. Basically, you cannot use methotrexate and you cannot use this other drug, leflunomide. It's another DMARD. You cannot use those agents in the setting of pregnancy. Now, another DMARD, right, that can be used on exams is sulfasalazine, right? Sulfasalazine actually works pretty well, but I mean, you can already begin to see the problems with it, right? It has sulfur in the name. Sulfasalazine has sulfur in the name, right? It can cause it has an association with like sulfur allergies. So if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has rheumatoid arthritis, you start a new medication, and then they have like a rash and their skin begins to like fall off and all that crap, maybe think about Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Sulfasalazine actually has that pretty strong association there. And sulfasalazine is actually one of those DMARDs that is actually safe in pregnancy. I'll just tell you this, the two DMARDs that are safe in pregnancy that show up all the time on exams, sulfasalazine and hydroxychloroquine. Okay, sulfasalazine and hydroxychloroquine, the two DMARDs that are unsafe in pregnancy are methotrexate and leflunomide. Okay, leflunomide. So other things to sort of kind of keep at the back of your mind, right? So the thing is, hydroxychloroquine, right? I mean, it's for the most part on exams, you use it for lupus. It's actually one of those drugs that has been shown to decrease mortality. That's very high yield to know. It has been shown to decrease mortality in the setting of lupus. You can also use it as a DMARD in the setting of a rheumatoid arthritis. Most times you don't use hydroxychloroquine as monotherapy. I mean, you can, but most rheumatologists, they actually do something called a triple therapy, where they give you a combination of methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and hydroxychloroquine, right? So they give you those three drugs. Actually, combining those three drugs has actually been shown to be more effective than using either of those drugs individually as monotherapy or even as bi-therapy, okay? So that triple therapy actually works. The triple therapy of methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and hydroxychloroquine has been shown to work pretty well, better than those other agents by many studies. But what are some key things you want to remember with hydroxychloroquine, right? So don't forget hydroxychloroquine, it can cause issues with the retina, right? It can cause retinal issues. That's like the big side effect you want to remember on your exam. And it's, again, it's also safe in pregnancy. And then leflunomide, literally all I would know about it if I were you is you cannot use it in pregnancy. It's a teratogen. But another series of drugs you want to keep in mind are your TNF inhibitors, right? Usually, if your DMARD doesn't work, if your methotrexate doesn't work, you can proceed to a TNF inhibitor, right? So your TNF inhibitors, like your infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab, and all that crap, right? And then there's one that's known as etanercept. Etanercept actually sort of deserves special mention because it presents with certain scenarios on the exam, right? So like etanercept, remember, it has an association with a drug induced lupus, right? So don't forget your classic antihistona antibodies with that. And the way etanercept works is it's a TNF inhibitor, but it's actually not a monoclonal antibody. It's actually like a decoy TNF receptor. So it's like kind of hangs around in the circulation, you know, moves around. And TNF is like, oh, look at my buddy. And then it binds to it, but it's a decoy receptor. So it basically inactivates a TNF that way. Don't forget the association on drug-induced lupus. But actually, this is one of those weird points that people will see on the exam and they're like, huh? What am I supposed to do with this? You need to remember this. This is floridly high yield for the ABIM exam. Etanercept has less risk of infection compared to the other TNF inhibitors, right? Remember, etanercept is like the decoy receptor. Pretty much every other TNF inhibitor is a monoclonal antibody, okay? Etanercept actually has less risk of infection because remember, these are essentially immunosuppressants, right? Etanercept has less risk of infection compared to the monoclonal TNF inhibitors, okay? And other scenarios they can give you, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, recently started treatment for rheumatoid arthritis, and then they tell you that the person has like rapidly progressive weakness, and you perform brain imaging and you see like extensive demyelination, what drug did they recently start on, right? They just started on rituximab, right? Remember, rituximab has a strong association with a progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, right? Although it's a very rare association, but it's just one of those annoying things that pops up on tests. Remember, right, that's from like reactivation of the JC virus. Another drug that classically on these exams that's associated with a PML, JC virus reactivation, is this drug that's used for MS, natalizumab, right? It's an alpha-4 integrin inhibitor. It's used in the treatment of MS. It can basically also, it actually has that pretty strong association with PML. Okay, and your TNF inhibitors, right? Obviously, before you start your TNF inhibitors, you want to make sure that you check for TB, right? Don't miss that question on the test. It shows up way too often, right? So check, go ahead and check for TB. If the patient has latent TB, you actually have to treat that latent TB before you start a TNF, inhibitor. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that's been treated for rheumatoid arthritis, he started on a new drug, and let's say he has a history of COPD, and then his COPD symptoms get worse. What drug are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about abatacept. That's probably all you need to know about abatacept. Abatacept, I believe it like inhibits one of the Janus kinases, like JAK3 or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. But basically, it can exacerbate a COPD. So that's probably the only thing you need to know. You need to know about it. I guess since I'm talking about JAK, what is the hematologic issue that's associated with like JAK-STAT mutations? I hope you're thinking about your polycythemia vera, right? Your polycythemia vera. Basically, those are myeloproliferative issues like your polycythemia vera, your essential thrombocythemia, and crap like that. Those are all associated with like the JAK mutations. It's just one of those things that, again, I promise you, shows up quite commonly on these exams. And then there's this drug that you may see on the test. It's called a tocilizumab. Literally, all you need to know about this is you probably want to get a lipid panel before you start the drug, because this drug can actually like screw up your lipids. It can like raise your LDL, for example. So that's pretty much all you need to know about like the pharmacology associated with rheumatoid arthritis. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I always do before I end every podcast, I do one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS Step 3 exams, and then the ABIM board exam. I do tutor people for those. The medicine and training exam. What else do I tutor? Preclinical exams in med school, shelf exams, right? So like all the shelf exams. And then for college students, if you have a college student acquaintance that needs tutoring in general chemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, physiology, physics, histology, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all those subjects. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS app, I do offer consulting and like one-on-one application advising, right? So like personal statements, preparing for interviews, like mock interviews, putting your application together to make it top-notch. Those are things I'll do. Like I always say, I've been on the admissions committee of a top two med school for a year, sifted through thousands of super high quality applications, so I know the things to kind of look out for that can make you stand out as an applicant. So if you need consulting with any of those things, feel free to reach out either through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of the night. I am super happy that the Raptors beat the Warriors. I know I've probably accumulated a smaller army of enemies that are Warriors fans, but I want someone else to win this year. So have a good night, sleep well, and I will see you in our next episode. Thank you and God bless you.